Heist at the Bank of the Black Ox. Written by Nels Challenor. Chapter 7.
Bobby Castle frowned down at a damp mustard stain on the collar of his best short sleeve button up. On his small metal desk lay a bottle of fizzy water, a rag, and the greasy remains of a deli sandwich wrapper. He had scrubbed until his hands were cramped and the checkered fabric of his shirt nearly worn through, but the small yellow spot remained. It was the kind of spot you know will last through at least one, possibly two or three, washings. Bobby mourned what would likely be the 2-week absence of this, his favorite shirt from his wardrobe. No sense in wasting money washing a shirt by itself, he figured. Bobby clamped his thumb and pointer finger around his clip-on tie, just below the knot that could never be undone, and ran his hand up and down the length of it. The feeling of cool fabric between his fingers gave him a slightly sexual surge of satisfaction. He pictured Julie Christie reclining on a sofa in a bra and panties, fanning herself with a fashion magazine. Her mouth was open, and her red lips were spread, awaiting his... The sound of a passing car brought him back to his present situation. The daydreams were occurring with more regularity since the summer began. Maybe it was the heat, or the lack of customers. Whatever it was, he would have to keep them under control. He was a professional, after all. Bobby stood, adjusting his pleated slacks by inserting a few fingers into the moistened waistline and tugging them from side to side. On removing his fingers, he fought the urge to smell them, eventually giving in and raising the tips to his nose in a fake yawn. They smelled like the 6-period gym locker room, suffused with the scent of sweat and worn elastic. The fake yawn gave way to a real yawn, a rather large one. His arms rose in an involuntary V as his chest collapsed. Bobby held himself this way for a moment after the yawn passed, eyes closed, stretching his body and feeling it strain against itself. He was still standing this way when he opened his eyes to see 3 men watching him through the plate glass window of the office. The 3 men made an odd collective. Their visible strangeness had something to do with the way they were positioned. The well-dressed man in the gray suit and Stetson, shoulder to shoulder with the shabby gentleman in the frayed trousers. A few feet away, a fat man leaned against the hood of a car, a bandage taped to his purple beak. His arms were crossed atop a tumescent stomach, and his foot tapped the ground, furiously, jiggling one side of his enormous body. Bobby couldn't quite pin down what exactly seemed off about the 3 men, but whatever it was not enough to stop him from exiting the humid interior of his office and stepping out into the sunlight, one arm raised in greeting. "Howdy!" Bobby called. "How y'all doing today?" Although a Seattle native, it was his habit to affect a poor southern accent when selling. "We need a car," the man in the gray suit responded, prompting a sarcastic snort from the fat man, who then clutched his throbbing nose, groaning in pain. "Well, then, you're in the right place," Bobby said, smiling. "What sort of car you thinking? What do you have in the way of trucks?" the shabby man asked. "Well, follow me," Bobby said. He led them around back, where a half-dozen pickups sunned themselves in a cracked asphalt lot. "Not much to choose from, I'm afraid. Stock's a little low at the moment." Graysuit walked the line, stopping in front of a red F-150. He popped the hood and inspected the engine for a few minutes. Turning back to Bobby, he said,
"We'll take this one."
"Care to take it for a test drive, partner?"
"No need," Graysuit said.
"Now, wait a minute," the fat man called, inserting himself between the 2 men with his back to Bobby. "I'm the one buying the car, and I think it's a good idea to see if what I'm buying can even run."
"Does it run?"
Graysuit asked Bobby over the fat man's shoulder.
"Like a stallion," Bobby answered. "You're going to take his word as bond?" the fat man continued. "He doesn't care. He'd probably tell you anything to get you to buy it."
Bobby placed a hand on the fat man's shoulder.
I see your point there, but I'm no liar. Believe me, she runs. Now, I agree that a man should never buy a vehicle unless he has a chance to get behind the wheel. So why don't you take her for a spin, and if you like the way she feels, she's yours.
The fat man shrugged Bobby's hand off his shoulder.
If I approve, maybe I'll think about purchasing it, but I'll have to see.
He reached for the door handle, but Graysuit stopped him.
No.
Graysuit said.
Excuse me?
The fat man asked.
I said no. You're not going for a drive. Neither are you going to buy this car. You're going to give me the money, and I'm going to buy it.
The fat man was speechless. He stammered, looking for help from the shabby man, who stood some distance away, smiling down at his boots. Bobby walked over and stood beside him, sensing the gathering storm between the two men, and knowing that the best thing to do in these situations was to walk away. Regardless of who would end up owning the car, he had already made the sale. The fat man attempted to calm himself, but his voice was cracking under the pressure.
Now, we'll see here, Pinkerton. I try to be a fair man, but you're pushing me to my limits. Why in God's name should I buy you a car with my money?
Leverage, Pinkerton responded. I don't know if I trust you, Harding.
You don't know if you trust me?
Harding proceeded to lose whatever sense of calm he had been tenuously holding.
I don't know if I trust you. I have done everything you asked of me. I brought the money. I came all the way up here with you. I'm putting all my trust in you. And yet still, you don't trust me. Oh, I should walk away right now.
The shabby man beside Bobby straightened, but Pinkerton shot him a glance that said in no uncertain terms, I got this.
Do it then,
Pinkerton said, stepping closer to Harding until the two men's faces were a mere inch apart. The brim of Pinkerton's Stetson grazed Harding's wrinkled forehead.
Walk away. Like I said, we don't need you. We don't want you. You've been nothing but a burden since we left Bullseye. Buy this truck yourself and drive away. Back to your comfortable little house and your comfortable little bank. Back to your little office where you can sit back on that big, fat ass and get rich off the backs of other people.
The mauve color around Harding's nose spread across the rest of his face. He said nothing.
I'm serious. Go!
Pinkerton pointed out the lot towards the road.
If you don't understand why I would want some insurance, some guarantee that all this work, everything I've done for us here, will result in a net gain for me, then you're even dumber than I took you for.
And why would you not get your share of the profit?
Harding asked sheepishly.
Because you're a wolf in a whale's clothing. You act all innocent and fair, but I know you. I've seen you my whole life in the background, skimming the profit off whoever you can. If there's one thing I know about money, it's that those who have it will do whatever they can to get more. Except work, of course.
How exactly would I take your portions, Pinkerton? By force?
Harding asked this question in a mocking tone, his arms spread like wings, showcasing his flabby body. Self-deprecation seemed to come easy to him.
Oh, no. You'd never use physical force. That'd be too much effort. Too much mess. But you'd bring the full force of the law down on us. You'd lawyer up, slap us with suit after suit, bury us up to our necks in fees and paperwork, and Murphy and I would be powerless to stop you because the law protects people like you.
Haven't you ever heard that the law is blind?
You know as well as I do that the law is not nearly as blind as we like to think. In fact, it sees everything. And look at us, you and me, right now. What do you see?
Harding opened his mouth to answer, but Pinkerton interrupted him.
I see one man in a $200 suit with a broken nose and a pocket full of dollars, and another man, a disgraced cop without a penny to his name, willing to risk everything because he has nothing.
Pinkerton placed a hand on the hood of the truck and slammed it shut.
You have two choices, Harding. Walk away right now, or shut up and do what I say. If we find the Jennies, and if we find someone willing to buy them, and if you don't fuck us and take all the money for yourself, then I'll think about paying you for the truck out of my portion. But until then, I'm going to assume your plan is to leave Murphy and me with the nothing we already have. So to protect our interests, you're going to buy me this truck.
While Pinkerton delivered this diatribe, his breathing was steady, and his eyes were clear. The brim of his Stetson had risen from its contact with Harding's forehead, and his scar tissue caught the sunlight, looking like rivulets streaming down his forehead and cheeks. Harding's face went from purple to pink to pale white. His mouth, which had been silently working over some response, some defense of his character, suddenly closed. His eyes narrowed, and what Bobby Castle could see was an intense, all-consuming hatred. If Harding had not been planning to screw Pinkerton out of the money that was coming their way, then he certainly was now. Pinkerton beckoned Bobby over.
My associate and I are going to run over to the hardware store while you and Harding talk money. When I get back, I'll sign whatever you need me to.
He turned to Harding.
Pay him whatever he wants.
Pinkerton and Murphy walked across the lot, leaving Harding behind. Bobby looked up at the large man with a slight grin playing across his face.
"And will you be paying in cash or a check, Mr. Harding?"
"Cash," Harding said. "And that's Mr. H to you."
Chapter 8.
Reginald D. Schwartz went to bed early. He felt as though his many years of dutiful service to the Bullseye community afforded him some leeway on the precise nature and timing of his retirement, which was fast approaching. As such, he had taken to unplugging his phone before getting in bed, confident that if something truly urgent were to come up, someone would come directly to his house to alert him. A year after beginning this practice, he had only had one visitor, and she had mainly been there to see his wife. Reginald and Louise Schwartz lived at 4 St. Luke's Road, a quiet cul-de-sac populated by elderly married couples like themselves. Their children were grown and had moved away long ago. Billy was a claims adjuster for the IRS in Portland. Rose lived with her husband Kurt in Texas. The Schwartz children were very good to their parents. They came home for Christmas. They called once a week. But still, like many aging parents, Reginald and Louise were always on the lookout for younger people that they could dote upon and fret over. The parental instinct never quite left them. Reginald had many young wards following his son's departure. Some had lasted only days, others stayed on for years. Some kept their distance, others seemed attached at the hip to the old sheriff. Though there had been many surrogate sons for Reginald Schwartz, the only one worth remembering was his former deputy, Lawrence Lavender, who was now whittling away his life at St. Teresa's home for the mentally unfit. Lawrence had been a fine lawman and a good friend. 2 years on the force in a large Midwestern city had been enough action to last him a lifetime, so he retreated to this small western town, where the police blotter was dominated by lost pets and drunken disorderlies. Lavender proved himself competent and kind. He never complained about the tedium or the meaninglessness of combing the thick woods for Mrs. Queen's Norwich Terrier, Toto. Never refused to drag old Bryce Sand to the tank and sit there watching to make sure he didn't wet himself all night. Some people lose their minds gradually. Old age turns up the heat in their skulls, and like a toad in a pot of water on the stove, they don't notice the difference until it's too late. Lawrence Lavender, on the other hand, lost his mind all at once. It was the 4th of July, annual street fair in Bullseye, and the whole town had gathered in the central square. Lawrence was on duty, out front of the bank of the Black Ox, where the Better Business Bureau had paid for a grandstand to be erected so that the members could sit above the crowd. All the members were up there, save Mr. H., who felt that as president he should make a grand entrance immediately after the high school marching band had finished playing the national anthem. Midway through the first verse, Lawrence noticed a slight wiggle in one of the struts of the grandstand. He went over to inspect it, only to find that it had been improperly constructed, and the aluminum bar was carrying a sharp bend. Lawrence knew he had to act quickly, so he leapt up and began shouting at those nearest to him to move to the exit. The Star-Spangled Banner drew to a close, and as Mr. H. left his bank, he found his entire social circle shoving their way off the grandstand. Furious that his cronies would abandon him at this moment, he used his enormous size to block their way. For a few seconds, Mr. H. and Lawrence entered into a game of inverted tug-of-war. Pushing the chain of robust male bodies from either side of the grandstand, and then, in a flash, the structure collapsed. A pile of businessmen rolling and bouncing off each other, down onto the pavement. The broken aluminum bar swung up and connected with Lawrence Lavender's face, tearing through the flesh as easily as a butcher knife through tissue paper. Lawrence Lavender lay in a coma for a year, with bandages wrapped tightly around his head. During that time, everyone in Bullseye stopped by to deliver flowers or cards or just to sit and talk to the unconscious lawman. Reginald Swartz would arrive for his weekly visit to find Mrs. Queen and Toto or Bryce Sand sitting beside the hospital bed. Elizabeth and Daisy Dickey regularly brought trays of banana nut muffins that, although Lawrence never had the chance to taste them, perfumed the room with the sweet aroma of home. Even Petunia and the girls showed up once or twice. Everyone went to see Lawrence Lavender, except, of course, Mr. H. Once the bandages had been taken off and he had awoken from his coma, Lawrence was unrecognizable. The facial scarring was extensive. Networks of grooves and ravines snaked across his forehead and cheeks, but the more significant difference between pre- and post-accident Lawrence Lavender was mental in character. Like Phineas Gage before him, Lawrence's personality had been forever changed by the bar that shattered his face. He was bitter and violent with the nursing staff. Visitors were prohibited from entering his room. After he bit a doctor who had been checking his temperature, the hospital transferred him to St. Teresa's. Reginald felt as if he had lost his friend twice. Once to the coma, and again to this new person, this new animal that had taken over his body. At first, his grief was too profound for him to make the trip up the hill to visit Lawrence, but the emotional turmoil eventually faded to a simmer, and Reginald found himself unable to go simply because he was too busy mentoring another young man and then another after that. For Louise Schwartz, the maternal instinct had a fixed target, Petunia Harding. Although Petunia was well into middle age, with daughters almost grown herself, she allowed Louise to mother her with only slight resistance. The two of them had a standing reservation at Gugino's, the town's only real restaurant, every Saturday at noon, where they would sit and talk about whatever women care to talk about when the men are not around. Reginald appreciated that Petunia provided his wife with something essential. He found her sharp and direct. A real pistol, he liked to tell Louise. But he kept his distance from the large, powerful woman. Something about her made him uncomfortable. Or maybe it was something about him. His pity, perhaps. The only time Reginald had been awoken in the night by a Bullseye resident in distress, he had sauntered to the door in robe and slippers, gray hair tousled, to find Petunia Harding in a low-cut evening gown. Her makeup was smeared and blotchy, and the bottom of her dress was caked with mud. "Petunia," he said, "what's the matter?" Before he could finish, she stepped inside and called for Louise, who emerged from the bedroom within seconds. In the light of the living room, Reginald saw that what he mistook for smeared makeup was actually a line of bruises running from Petunia's right eye down her plump cheek. Small red crescents showed where Warren's gold ring had broken the skin. Oh, honey, Louise whimpered, escorting Petunia to the kitchen. Reginald heard the sound of the burner coming to life and a kettle settling on the grate. He stood in the living room, looking out the open door at the darkened street, unsure what to do next. Later, after Louise had settled Petunia into a warm bath, she found her husband standing in the living room right where she had left him several hours earlier. "Should I take a drive over there?" Reginald asked her. Louise shook her head. "She's not interested in pressing charges. Besides, you know how he is. If he sees you, it will only make him more upset." "Bastard." Reginald spat. Louise nodded. "I'll drive her back over tomorrow morning. I think it's best if she sleeps here tonight." "Yes, I suppose you're right. You two share the bed. I'll stay out here." Reginald did not sleep that night. He sat on the couch, drinking black coffee and staring out the window at the darkened street. He was waiting for Mr. H, without a thought as to what he would do if he saw the banker's Cadillac rolling up St. Luke's Road towards his house. But he knew that he would defend Petunia as if she were one of his own children. Mr. H never showed. But every night since, Reginald thought of Petunia's bruised and bloodied face as he lay in bed. It was bound to happen again. And what would he do then? He nightly relived the experience, changing the ending so that he came out like a hero. He thought of himself as a principled man, a strong man, a man who would, at a moment's notice, stand up for the downtrodden and the abused. This was, for him, the true meaning of the law, as simple as doing the right thing at the right time. But after nearly half a century as the sheriff of Bullseye, he knew that the right thing and the right time were elusive concepts. Could a black eye for a black eye spell blindness? If so, maybe blindness was more powerful than sight, or at least more effective. And what of Lawrence Lavender, punished for trying to do the right thing? Was it right to send him away? His violent behavior would have been a threat to the order of the town, but it seemed that adding incarceration to injury was fundamentally wrong. It dawned on Reginald that the right thing and the right time were two handfuls of sand, that after they slip away, you can never find them again. And if the law amounted to nothing more than handfuls of sand, was there any truth in it at all? Was there any truth in him? These questions swirled inside Reginald's weary brain as he lay next to his gently snoring wife. Reginald Schwartz went to bed early, but he rarely slept.
Chapter 9.
Leon Clark watched an eagle alight from its perch atop a Douglas fir and soar across an iron sky. He pulled his brown suede coat tighter around his chest. It had been a warm and sunny morning when he left Port Angeles, but the clouds had proliferated as he made his way up the mountain. He had been lucky to hitch a ride. This late in the summer, there were few trucks making the trip up the ridge, and the ones that were on the road were working on tight schedules. Not a word had passed between Leon and the driver until he pulled to a hissing stop beside the trailhead, at which point he rested his hands in his lap and said, "Here you go." Leon had nodded. No thank you, no goodbye. He had left the vehicle and leaned against a stunted cedar just off the gravel road. The truck had disappeared in a cloud of white dust, while Leon concentrated on his breath, watching it turn to steam at each exhalation. And then he spotted the eagle. The freedom to fly was something he had always envied in birds. Growing up in the Carmel Valley, there had been plenty of room to move, but nowhere to go. He had spent his free time driving aimlessly, passing field after field, the parallel rows of crops seeming to come together way off in the distance. Once, his father had shown him a picture of farmland, photographed from the window of a plane, and he had fallen in love with the image, a chaotic puzzle in earth tones, no two pieces the same color or shape. From the ground, though, the fields were unremarkable, nothing but a solemn reminder of his predestined existence. To farm, and only to farm, that was his lot. In rebellion, he left, made it to San Francisco and fell in with a bad crew. Leon Clark had done many things he was not proud of, but he had paid for those things. He had been deprived of his freedom for 10 years, and now he would finally fly. Leon heard the roar of an engine and the crunch of heavy tires on gravel. A red F-150 appeared, the bed loaded with tools that rattled and clanked as the vehicle jounced over the uneven road. The truck pulled over a few yards from Leon. He kicked himself off his perch. The doors of the truck popped open. Murphy and Pinkerton emerged. The three men congregated at the rear of the vehicle. Murphy recounted the journey thus far, the enticement of Mr. H, the night train to Seattle, the troubled scene at Bobby Castle's car dealership, the ride out to Port Angeles. Just as Leon began to open his mouth to ask after the banker's whereabouts, Mr. H stepped out of the truck into the morning light, stretching his chubby arms out into a yawn. Mr. H's suit was wrinkled and his face was smeared with dried blood in places, but he still maintained a semblance of his usual put-together self.
"And who do we have here?"
Mr. H asked, offering a dry hand to Leon, who took it without comment. "Our guide," Pinkerton answered.
"Let me guess. Another partner? Another equal share?"
Mr. H said, sneering through his words. Pinkerton nodded. "Unless you want to get lost." Mr. H snorted in contempt, but kept his mouth shut. Leon and Pinkerton began removing tools from the truck bed, shovels, picks, pitchforks, lanterns, and stacking them in a loose pile beside the trailhead. Pinkerton flinched as the tumbling metal blades sang out against one another. Mr. H went for his bags, unloading them and laying them next to the tools. "What are you going to do with those?" Pinkerton asked.
"Always be prepared,"
Mr. H said as he swiveled his head in search of Murphy.
"Right? Where's Murphy? Isn't he coming?"
"Watching the truck," Pinkerton explained. Mr. H looked around at the deserted mountain road.
"Is that really necessary?"
"Aside from the occasional lumber truck, the only people liable to be out here would strip or bear and sell the parts for scrap if no one was around," Pinkerton said.
"Isn't that a bit dangerous for men, then?"
Mr. H asked. "Not really," Pinkerton said, slamming the tailgate closed. "Tweakers are more like vultures than lions." Leon tied the shovels together and slung them around his shoulder. Pinkerton did the same with the picks and pitchforks. Each of them took a lantern. Mr. H inspected his bags for a moment, then he mumbled to himself, a barely audible,
"Yes, I don't need these."
He unzipped the largest and withdrew a silver box about the size of a humidor. Inside was a compass engraved with filigrees and polished to a lustrous shine. The compass had been his father's. Mr. H had never had the chance to use it. The three men plunged into the forest. The air between the trees was thick and damp, soaking through their clothes and pruning their skin. The path branched and forked, crisscrossing other paths and forming a maze of worn dirt in the moss and underbrush. Leon led by instinct, retracing his steps he remembered from his bootlegging days when he was hauling product for Pillbox Larry, the infamous San Francisco gangster. Leon had walked this trail with shovels on his back many times, his arms weighed down by whatever contraband Pillbox had tasked him with transporting guns, drugs, or investments, which was Pillbox's terms for any valuable item too hot to fence. Leon would trek up the ridge, bury the goods, and retrieve them on a subsequent trip several months later. This section of Olympic National Park was perfect for stashing, close enough to the 101 to be easily accessed, but far enough from any major towns to avoid unwanted attention. Leon had told Pinkerton and Murphy about the place, had told them about some of the things he had stashed for Pillbox over the years, about how he had retrieved all these items piecemeal, the stash spot being too far from the road to haul large things there and back. Rangers were the only authority out here, and according to Leon, they were too few and far between to be a real threat. The path wound around boulders and over streams. At each fork, Leon trudged steadily onwards, reading his surroundings. He looked for holes in the canopy, certain compositions of soil, stands of alder or cedar. All these details were clues, invisible to the untrained eye, that pointed away through the dense forest to the top of the ridge. For the first few hours, Mr. H. stopped at each turn to take a bearing on his antique compass, but he soon grew weary of the practice, and the silver box remained closed in his outstretched arms. By mid-afternoon, they had reached the source of the streams, Lake Angeles. The lake was tear-shaped, the water translucent and tinged green like an empty beer bottle. Logs crowded around the shore, their bark stripped off over time by the frigid water. The three men rested for a moment. Leon leaned against one of the logs, hands jammed in the pockets of his jeans. Pinkerton sat smoking his Marlboro Reds, his jacket removed and resting on a nearby rock. The brim of his Stetson was turned up, and Mr. H. could see his scarred face clearly in the gray sunlight. The smooth grip of Pinkerton's revolver was visible against his black leather belt. Mr. H. was decidedly less put together than he had been down at the car. His suit was torn in places, mud and bits of leaf clung to his pant legs. His face was so deep, a hue of crimson, that it almost looked purple. He breathed in large, gulping gasps, whooshing in and out of his mouth-like bellows into a fire. He reached down and began unlacing one of his shoes. "Best not," Leon said in a soft and breathy voice. "If you take them off, you may not be able to get them back on, and we got a ways to go yet." Mr. H. reluctantly did as he was told, and the three men were soon on the move once again. They skirted the lake, watching as the shadow of the ridge crept across the surface. At a bend where the path continued east along the water, they turned west. Leon split a swish off a snag and used it to clear the brush out of the way. But there were fallen trees to climb over, and though Pinkerton and Leon could vault over them, Mr. H. was reduced to setting his compass aside and rolling his body over top. As the grade steepened and the trees grew shorter, their progress slowed to accommodate Mr. H.'s bumbling movements. Then they scrambled over a few rocky outcroppings, and they were standing at the top of the ridge. The three men paused and looked out over the blanket of clouds, broken here and there by a peak or a mountain range. Mr. H. stifled a gasp. This was the moment he had been waiting for. Looking down at the rest of the world, smelling and tasting the fresh mountain air, and hearing it whistle across the summit, he had never felt so alive. They walked along the ridge for a half mile, then turned and began descending the backside away from where they had come. In the fading light, the trees were black and menacing, jagged spears warning them to turn back. But they trudged on, picking their way down the slope until they made it to their destination. A small clearing surrounded on all sides by a wall of Douglas firs. The cave that Mr. H. had been expecting was really more of a mossy overhang on one side of the clearing. Pinkerton and Leon deposited the tools beneath it and set up the lanterns so as to maximize the areas covered by their weak light.
"Now what?"
Mr. H. asked. "Now we dig," Pinkerton said. Leon took up a pitchfork and began clearing away the grass, moss, and topsoil. As the patch of virgin dirt began to grow, Pinkerton came in with a pick. The two worked for a while until Mr. H., bored of watching the other man work, took a shovel and began removing the loosened soil. They worked deep into the night, the hole growing steadily in width and depth. They began alternating. One would shovel while the other two sat nearby, resting their eyes or smoking, in Pinkerton's case. When the hole got to be more than 2 yards deep and Mr. H. could no longer climb out, Pinkerton and Leon traded off digging, while the banker stood by, eyeing the hole, expectantly awaiting the clunk of shovel on a hollow chest. But the sound never came, and the night wore on.
"How deep do you think we have to go?"
Mr. H. asked as Pinkerton leapt up to their outstretched arms. Mr. H. and Leon pulled as Pinkerton scrambled up out of the hole. "Don't know," Pinkerton said, brushing dirt from his pant legs and grabbing the pack from his jacket pocket. Mr. H. stared at his partner. His eyebrows rose. A possibility dawned on him. Something he should have considered long ago, before he even left Bullseye. Something that had occurred to his wife. He had been too wrapped up in the spirit of adventure to bother with the details. For the first time in his memory, Mr. H. felt a band of sweat collect around his forehead.
"How do we even know it's here?"
Leon and Pinkerton looked at each other, A simultaneous grin spread across their faces.
No! Mr. H moaned. No! You can't be serious, so why? Why am I here?
He felt like screaming, but he knew no one would hear except Pinkerton and Leon, and they were clearly deaf to his pain. He twirled his signet ring around his pinky, thinking as fast as his weary brain would allow.
You butskers! You animals! Bringing me out here to...
His voice dropped from a shout to a broken whisper.
Please!
He said, looking up into the two sets of eyes on him. His tone sounded unfamiliar in his ears. He was not shrewd. He was not in control. Fear crept into his voice and destabilized it.
Please don't do this. I'll give you anything. I'll give you the rest of the money. Here! Here!
Mr. H took a wad of cash from his breast pocket and threw it on the ground. Leon stooped and picked up the bills. He smoothed them between his hands before tucking them away in his own breast pocket. Pinkerton and Leon stayed put, staring at Mr. H as he tried to make every deal he could think of.
The truck! It's yours! No argument! I'll even throw in the tools! Please, we can work this out! We can!
His voice, already broken, shattered, and his body collapsing, heaved into great sobs. Tears streamed down his smashed face and collected in drops, which hung from his puffy chin. Snot oozed from his broken nose.
Have my ring, for God's sakes! It's solid gold! This is 24 carats!
Mr. H said through sobs. He removed his signet ring and tossed it to Pinkerton, who let it fall into the dirt at his feet. Pinkerton took a few steps toward the crying man. Mr. H sat with his legs stretched out in front of him. The former lawman stooped, the lantern light catching the scars on his face and making them shine. Then he withdrew the revolver from its holster and held it to Mr. H's temples. Any last words, Mr. Harding? Pinkerton asked.
What did I ever do to you?
Pinkerton removed his Stetson with his free hand. He set the hat to his side and stared deeply into Mr. H's eyes. The scars on his face ran up through his scalp, weaving between tufts of black hair. Beneath the scar tissue, Mr. H saw a face he hadn't seen in 10 years, not since the incident with the grandstand on the steps of his bank. As Mr. H's eyes widened in recognition, Pinkerton pulled the trigger. Mr. H's eyes snapped shut again. A loud pop sounded in the clearing, and Mr. H felt a puff of warm air against his head. He opened one eye. Pinkerton was grinning, blowing a thin curl of smoke from the barrel of the cap gun. So
you're not... You're not...
Mr. H wondered aloud. No, we're not going to kill you, Mr. Harding, Pinkerton said. You'll do a good enough job of that yourself. Leon walked over and grabbed the compass. He held it before him like a sacred relic. Before he handed it off to Pinkerton, he dusted off the top with one suede sleeve. Pinkerton took the compass and pitched it into the hole. Mr. H turned to see his father's compass stick into the soft dirt. Pinkerton picked up one of the pitchforks that lay nearby. He placed the sharp tines against Mr. H's broad cotton-clad bottom and pushed. The large man tumbled headfirst after the compass, landing in a pile at the bottom of the hole. You can keep the compass. Maybe it'll show you a way out of that hole. Pinkerton said, chuckling. After righting himself, Mr. H tried to pull himself out. He jumped, but his meager attempt to reach the lip failed, and he slid back down to the bottom. He tried to climb, but the soft dirt came off in his hands. He couldn't get a grip. Finally, he took a running jump, but his body merely bounced off the high wall. In a panic, he began pounding his fist against the ground and shouting,
"Lavender!"
he called.
"Lavender!"
Pinkerton heard Mr. H's shout, muffled by the damp night air and the growing distance between them and the banker. He smiled. "That was the last we heard of him," he said. Leon Clark smiled back, thinking of the day when Pinkerton would be saying the same thing about him.
Heist at the Bank of the Black Ox. Written by Nels Challenor. Produced by Jesse Rosenthal. Chapter 7, read by Luke Rosenthal. 8 by Joel Underwood, and 9 by Ted Dowling.